But something wasn't right for me. It seemed like something was off. And I was just walking across campus one day, and it just kind of hit me that my problem, and perhaps a problem of the world, was that I had disconnected myself from the very thing that gives life. And I call that thing God.
On In Good Faith, we believe that all faith traditions have something to teach us about how God is working in the world and in our lives. So join us as we listen and learn and discover how speaking with people of other faiths can strengthen our own faith and even our own practice. If we're lucky, we get to have many mentors in our lives. And sometimes we know who they are. It seems obvious, like a parent or a grandparent who shows us how to fix a car or some other useful skill. But we might not know who our mentors are until later. I spent the first half of my working life writing and producing music and stage shows, and somebody asked at one point, "How do you know how to do this?" And as I looked back, I realized it was every director I had ever worked with, observing them and being open to critique, and especially being encouraged by them. Our guest today is quick to give credit to some very important and influential teachers of his who pointed him along the way to what he does today and now finds himself being the kind of person who pays it forward to help other people thrive. Reverend Frederick Davey is Senior Executive Vice President for Public Theology and Civic Engagement at Union Theological Seminary. He's the co-chair of the Interfaith Center of New York and the co-chair of the Advisory Board for the Center of Earth Ethics. Mr. Davey is also a member of the Bureau of the NGO Committee for Freedom of Religion or Belief.
When I was a very young kid, twice I remember I was asked what I wanted to be when I grew up. Once with my relatives, and I was probably 8 or 9, and I said I wanted to be a preacher.
Wow.
And then in the first grade, there was a show that came on TV every afternoon. I grew up in Belmont, North Carolina, which is near Charlotte. And so this show was on a Charlotte TV station. It was a show with kids and clowns and Big Bill Ward every afternoon. And they would bring different groups of kids from youth groups at churches, et cetera, to be on the show. And then Big Bill Ward would go around and ask each kid what he wanted to be. And I said, "Oh, I want to be a minister." And I was probably 5 or 6 then. Having said that, it's been quite a circuitous route to actually get there, in the sense that I grew up in the church. I grew up Presbyterian, which is somewhat unusual to be a Black Presbyterian in the South, but I was. And we had to go to church. It wasn't anything like, maybe we'll go to church or I might go this Sunday. No, that was not happening in my household. We had to go to church every Sunday. And if you didn't go to church, you couldn't go out. I then graduated from high school. I went to college, majored in political science, but the school required, Greensboro College required courses in religion to graduate because it's affiliated with the United Methodist Church. And so in the summer of, I think it was probably 1976, I took a course on the prophets to fulfill my religion requirement and just fell in love with it. I had grown up with this notion that you couldn't question the Bible and you couldn't question the faith. And as we know, the prophets shake their fist at God sometimes, as do the psalmists. And I thought, oh, this feels very real to me. And I had an aching in my soul at the time for something different, that something wasn't quite right, that my spiritual life wasn't quite what it should be. So I rededicated myself to my faith. I was in this course in the summer, and I started taking more religion courses as electives at Greensboro College. And when I graduated, I really didn't know what I wanted to do. And one of my mentors, a college professor, the late Dr. James Hull, who taught that prophets course, suggested that I think about seminary. So he and I sat down, and we filled out a number of applications, and I got accepted to a number of schools, and we decided on Union Presbyterian Seminary in Richmond, Virginia. So I went there, and I went there for 2 years. I really enjoyed my time at Union, but I felt something was missing. So I decided to transfer to Yale Divinity School at the recommendation of a good friend from Union Presbyterian Seminary who had gone to Yale. And so I came up to Yale Div, and if Union Presbyterian opened a door for me, Yale Divinity School in many ways opened the world to me and helped me to think theologically and religiously and spiritually, to live in those ways I never thought I would. I'll just say one more thing and then I'll take a breath. That is that I decided to get in the ordination track at the encouragement of my home pastor. He was a great man, the late Reverend Paul Ross. And while at Yale Divinity School and a candidate for ministry in my home presbytery, I met a man by the name of Calvin Presley, who was the executive director of the New York City Mission Society. He came to Yale to teach at one of my classes one day, to speak at one of the classes. And he talked about his work as an ordained minister working through a nonprofit, at that time the oldest existing private social service agency in New York City, called the New York City Mission Society. And he talked about all the work that the Mission Society did from a faith and religious perspective, but still as a non-sectarian organization, and his managing it as a United Methodist minister. And I said, that's what I want to do. So I told him. And lo and behold, he sent me a letter and asked me to come down to New York to see him. And they said, when you graduate, I'd like for you to come work for me. And then my home pastor said, well, you know, you can actually be ordained as a Presbyterian minister to work in a nonprofit. I got ordained by the Presbytery of Catawba. And on graduating from Yale Divinity School, I came to New York City and went to work as the assistant executive director of the New York City Mission Society. So there was something obviously in the air, right, or in my soul,
yeah,
that had captured me as a kid to make those statements that I wanted to be a minister. It certainly, my faith took a real turn when I was 20, and then graduating and going to seminary and divinity school and coming to New York, working in these organizations, was an affirmation of this call to a particular kind of ministry that I've now done for 43 years.
I'd love to sort of dig back and compare your childhood perception of God and believing with what happened later. Do you remember just accepting what you were taught, or was there a moment where you thought, wait, I actually am not just being taught this, but I believe this, or I connect with God in some way?
We grew up in a little Presbyterian church. And then the next big step after baptism, which I don't remember, obviously, because we do infant baptisms there. Mm-hmm. You join the church. You formally join the church as a young adult. And I remember that being a pretty profound experience. I remember actually crying the day that I actually came up to join the church. And so I loved church till my high school years, but probably feared God or didn't understand God. And I knew Jesus was in there somewhere and was a son of God, but I couldn't make a whole lot of sense. All I knew was, as the old folks would say, something had a hold of me and I didn't quite know what it was, right?
What a great phrase.
It was true. Now, you know, as I look back on it, I had a period where I declared myself an atheist, that I didn't believe in God because I couldn't make any intellectual sense out of God. That was probably from the time I was about 17 or 18 until that day, April 28th, 1976. Greensboro College, that thing that had a hold of me really got a hold of me. Yeah, so my relationship was with the church and my family and my friends. And I love, you know, the music and most of the preaching and the deep cultural, social, and religious aspects of it all. But in terms of a personal relationship and a personal understanding with God, that was less formed.
And what was it about your theological studies and in your 20s that seemed to help you make a connection again? Was it an event or just all the things you were learning?
I think it was the things I was learning and then the way I was living. On the one hand, I had a phenomenal first year at Greensboro College, but something wasn't right for me. It seemed like something was off. And I was just walking across campus one day, and it just kind of hit me that my problem, and perhaps a problem of the world, was that I had disconnected myself from the very thing that gives life. And I call that thing God. At the time, it came to me that God had best presented God's self in and through the life and death and resurrection of Jesus. And I wanted to embrace that as my own.
I'm just wondering what drew you into the idea of public theology and what you've been able to do, whether it's with presidential administration or locally. I should have mentioned that you are a Presbyterian minister in the Presbytery of New York City, and you've served the National Presbyterian Church, the New York City Presbytery, and local congregations. So you've got this really wide range of right there in the church with the people who come and support each other and know each other so well, all the way to this sort of interfaith vision. What drew you into that?
I think primarily growing up, the church was at the center of all of life for me in my little town, right?
Right.
So when people had problems, no matter what they were, generally it was someone in our church or one of the other churches or the ministers or someone who was going to address it. I came along just as the civil rights movement was in full force, you know, in the mid-60s as a preteen, but aware of Martin Luther King Jr. and Jesse Jackson and my own minister, you know, involved with other ministers in the town addressing issues of racial discrimination and segregation. And so for me, there was never any light between the church and social change, between faith and social change.
Always connected.
Always connected. In fact, I've only thought about this looking back a lot over the decades, but to be a good Christian was, among other things, to be about doing good for others. And that meant that you had to create a world and community so that other people could thrive and live. So it was baked in from as long as I can remember. I have to admit, when people started making the distinction between personal faith and community and social change and healing, I was kind of like, what are you talking about? How can you do that? You know, there is no personal faith without working to make this world better. My career has always been focused at the intersection of my faith and the public square. Everything that I've done since leaving Yale Divinity School has had that frame to it. I also served in government. I was chief of staff to the president of the New York City Board of Education, chief of staff to a deputy mayor during the Dinkins administration. I was deputy borough president of Manhattan with Manhattan borough president Ruth Messenger for 3.5 years. And so even in those jobs, I worked intentionally to ensure that faith and faith leaders had a voice in the conversations about public policy.
And could I ask for just a minute, what kinds of things would you bring up, or what influence would that have on public policy?
Everything from homelessness and housing. So we did work with faith groups to organize around rehabilitating abandoned buildings in Brooklyn. A group of folks who wanted to see better education for our kids. So when I was chief of staff to the president of the Board of Ed, we made sure that those voices got heard when we were doing education policy. We had big fights around multicultural curriculum, which I believed in, and a number of clergy people that I was associated believed in. There were clergy people who didn't believe in it. So we had alternative religious voices at the table when it came to these issues. Same in the mayor's office, same in the borough president's office. Just trying to ensure that those forward-thinking religious voices got heard, and that the primary coalitions were with people and faith leaders who were interested in inviting more and more people to the table, building diverse coalitions racially, gender identities and orientations, faith expressions. So it was building out that coalition, building community with those coalitions, and making sure that those folks who wanted to see more people included and empowered in the society were involved in those public conversations.
Well, I imagine that can be both discouraging and hopeful.
Yeah, definitely. The good thing about hope is that it is not necessarily dependent on what's going on around you, thank God. So when things don't always go our way, there was still a community of people with which to engage, to be sustained through these efforts to move and make society be the kind of place where as many people as possible can thrive and flourish. And today, I think it's really important for those of us who believe in a society and a world that embraces people from a variety of different backgrounds, that tries to have compassion and care as a primary way in which we orient ourselves, I think it's really crucial for us as people of faith to be in the square saying that, particularly as it relates now in this current era to some of the, what I consider to be atrocities going on around immigration issues. The church, compassionate people of faith need to have something to say about that kind of public policy. So yeah, it can be both encouraging, but it can also be a challenge, particularly when people are saying, my charity starts with people I love first, and then the other people get it later. Well, I think we need to offer an alternative to that. And that's why I think it's important for us to have a variety of faith voices in the public square.
Hi, Stephen Cap Perry here, host of In Good Faith. Here's another podcast from our BYU Radio family of podcasts I hope you'll check out. What I Love is Real. You know that saying, real recognize real? That's Lisa on The Lisa Show. Lisa Valentine Clark is a comedian, she's a believer, a single mother, and on The Lisa Show podcast, you'll hear from the Council of Moms, a genius idea which is actually one of my favorite parts of her show. And you'll hear about the challenges of life, parenting, mental health questions, social issues. Yes, you'll hear from experts, but also from people discussing their where the rubber meets the road life experience. It's The Lisa Show, wherever you get your podcasts. This is In Good Faith. We're speaking with Reverend Frederick Davey of Union Theological Seminary. Sometimes an institution, whether it's the Presbyterian Church, United Methodist, whatever it might be, the institution as a whole sometimes seems to be in a different page than the people in the pews with some of these issues, whether it's being an affirming congregation or immigration, as you said. I think we sort of imagine change comes from the top, that people are seeking inspiration on how to do things, but so often it seems like it's bubbling up from the people in the pews.
Yes, I think there's a role for the institutions and leaders to pull the people along and then people in to push and cajole and compel the institutions. And that can be a healthy dynamic, but obviously sometimes it gets out of balance. If you think about my own denomination on being welcoming and affirming and fully inclusive, it was a long struggle. And it took people across the country to move the institution, the Presbyterian Church USA itself, to become a more welcoming denomination. And certainly local congregations were doing that for a while. When I came to grips with my sexuality and who I am as a person in my fullness, I was very open with people I knew, but I was not necessarily professional. And then in 1986, I was invited to join the presbytery staff as an associate executive presbyter. And I thought, well, if I'm going to do this, people have to know. And so I talked to the executive presbyter and I said, you know, you should have to know this. He said, well, it's not a very well-kept secret, Fred, if that's what you're worried about. And he said, it is because of who you are in your fullness and completeness that we want to welcome you into this position. So in 1986, being an out Presbyterian minister in New York City was not a major deal. It still raised eyebrows and people were still talking, but it wasn't a major deal. In the church, of course, it was a huge deal. That said, someone could have easily brought a charge against the Presbytery of New York City for me being in that position with the national church, and it never happened. And it was situations like those that existed in Presbytery of New York City and places and churches and presbyteries around the country that ultimately brought the national church along. So in that sense, I do agree that many times this bubbles up from the people who are on the ground doing this every day, engaging with each other every day, being neighbors and friends every day, going to church together every day, that these changes happen. But sometimes it's prophetic preachers and administrators and priests and bishops who have to call the congregations and the local people to say, hey, look, we realize the zeitgeist says X when it comes to running people out of the country, but we've got a whole portfolio of scripture over here that talks about something else. So before you get too caught up in the zeitgeist, we want to hear again, thus saith the Lord, when it comes to the neighbor and the stranger and the person in need. So it goes both ways, it seems to me.
You've had a lot of interfaith experience
How has that affected your own faith or taught you about how God is working in the world to work with people not only of other Christian faiths, but even beyond that?
As a part of this journey, it has been to come to understand that God can't be contained.
That shouldn't be a surprise when you put it that way.
But that's what we spend a lot of time doing. We want these claims of exclusivity as opposed to universality. And I'm a more universalist kind of guy in that I believe that God manifests God's self in so many ways and through so many people and is not contained by my very limited Christian understanding of God. And I've seen the beauty of God expressed in people with no faith and expressed in people who have very different faith traditions than my own. And I want to build common cause. I want to join hands. I always have. You know, the Brooklyn Ecumenical Cooperative, we reached out in the early 80s and we invited a synagogue from Brooklyn Heights to join the coalition, and they did. And ultimately, it expanded to others. I'm fortunate that I landed in a place where engaging faith expressions of all types was very important, and people saw it as important and saw it as crucial to building community, to ensuring the welfare of the city. And so I've been able to build on that and expand that over the course of my career. And I'm glad it's become second nature. Every Friday morning, some manifestations of an interfaith group gets on the phone for about an hour to talk about different things we're going to do. I've had the good fortune of being involved with what's now called Interfaith America, started by Eboo Patel, an Ismaili Muslim. And it's been phenomenal to watch, particularly Interfaith America's work with young people and building young leaders around interfaith projects. And now Union Seminary, rooted in Christianity, is an interreligious seminary. So in addition to offering the traditional degrees that you'd expect in a seminary that was started by Christians way back when, we also offer degrees in Buddhism and interreligious engagement, Islam, and we have non-Abrahamic faculty. So it wasn't intentional, but it just was the right course, it felt. This is just how you do it. If I'm going to be a person of faith, then embracing other faith expressions, other people of goodwill, was at the core, or is at the core of that for me.
I love what you said, people of goodwill. That's kind of a requirement, even if they want to do good, but don't know how to yet in this area. You're making me think of one of my favorite religious artists, J. Kirk Richards. Right at the moment he started to have some success, he started making time to promote other artists, sometimes teaching classes or organizing figure drawing sessions for them. And now that he's much more successful, he still makes time to teach and promote upcoming religious artists of any faith, even organizing shows that include their work along with his. That commitment to paying it forward for his community is really inspiring to me. And I think that's something you do as well. What are a few things someone could do in a community where they really don't have a lot of interfaith interaction going on at the moment?
That is a very good question. I would say build a relationship, and it doesn't have to be formal. There's just a richness from engaging beyond one's comfort level of what one's used to. And there's so much good that can come from doing that. If you've got a colleague at work, like to know a little bit more about what it is that Sikhs do, or tell me more about your prayers at the mosque on Fridays.
I'm wondering if I could ask how you perceive guidance or direction. Some people say, well, I heard this song and I felt inspired to do whatever, or I prayed and God came into my mind and pointed this out. What has that been like for you?
A little bit of all of the above. People influence me a lot, and I'm very blessed that I've had very good and positive influences in my life. One of them was the late Henry Nouwen, who was a professor at Yale Divinity School when I was there. But Henry taught me the value of spiritual discipline, a daily discipline of building that relationship between ourselves and the divine. And so for almost 45 years, 50 years, I wake up every morning, and whether I have 10 minutes or half an hour, I take that time to read a reflection. I take that time to ask God to come into my life, be in my life, help me through the day. The old folks used to talk about getting all prayed up. Well, I'd get all prayed up before I went out for the day. And I have Henry Nouwen to thank for that. And I will tell you throughout the day, regardless of where, what job I've been in, where I've been, I take some time to pray. Lord, I need some help to figure out how I'm going to manage this, you know? And I know that inspiration comes. I've felt it. I've experienced it. I've marveled at it even. And then I have to remind myself to be that one of the 99 that just come back and say thank you, to remember to express gratitude and appreciation when those revelatory moments have happened, particularly when they've happened in the midst of crisis.
I'm so appreciative of your time and how you've inspired me, and I'm sure our listeners. Is there something I should have asked you that I didn't know to ask?
I think I should say that one of the ways that I feel like I've been very blessed is one family. I'm very close to my siblings. They are just special people for me and in my life. And they've been very supportive of me. And I hope I have been of them over the years. The other would say, I would say, is my home life. Having a partner, a spouse of now 27 years, there's a kind of depth of richness there that is just wonderful and that I wish everybody could experience. Yes. I used to tell people that the one reason that I had any confidence to do anything was that I always knew I could go home.
Ah.
That if things got bad, I could always knock on my mother's door and she was going to open it and let me in. I say the same for my sibs. I say the same thing for Michael's family. And being surrounded by loving family and friends, having incredible loving domestic home life makes, I think, all the rest of this possible and is a gift from God in and of itself that I'm very appreciative of.
Many thanks to Reverend Frederick Davey for speaking with me. This episode was produced by Heidi Clough. Our production team also includes Heather Bigley, Nick Levitt, and Ocean Marshall. Our post-production sound designers are Mark Hansen and DJ Cromarty. In Good Faith is committed to the idea that we all benefit from hearing people of widely varying backgrounds share their personal experience with faith and belief. In fact, we think people with such experience deserve some of our best listening. Find us on Instagram and Facebook at In Good Faith Podcast. Also, check out our YouTube channel for extended interviews. In Good Faith is a production of BYU Radio. I'm Stephen Cap Perry. I hope you join me again soon, right here, in Good Faith.
There is power in stories. They inspire us. They help us see ways we might try doing things. And sometimes a story will even tell us not to go down that particular path. And it's nice to learn that from a story or a conversation before you experience it yourself. Hi, Stephen Cap Perry here from the In Good Faith podcast. I love stories because what they teach me about people, about God, about politics, about everything. And I hope you will check out the brand new podcast, Uncomfy, Sticking with Moments That Challenge Us. There is so much to learn from the stories of these guests because they are people who found themselves in an uncomfortable moment. They could have just left the situation, written off the people they disagreed with, but instead they made something beautiful out of it. And you can learn how, and I know you like the stories. This is hosted by Julie Rose, the host of Top of Mind. She does a great job, and I know you love the guests and their stories. Check out Uncomfy.